Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
Imagine being diagnosed with a rare and progressive lung disease the very first week of your residency. How the condition manifests itself in my guests' personal and professional life will surprise you. Next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Lindsay Hoy. Dr. Hoy is a rare disease advocate. She is a co-founder of RX Museum, a medical humanities initiative bridging medicine and the visual arts. Her path as a physician leader has been varied and is extraordinarily interesting. Lindsay Hoy, welcome to Sound Practice.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's great to be here with you.
I'm excited to talk with you. I briefly alluded that you have a very interesting background. Can you tell me about your path to becoming a physician leader?
Sure. Well, as you kindly began with, I am a co-founder of a medical humanities initiative, but I would actually widen the lens and back up a little bit and really link my somewhat unusual path to being where I am to a confluence of factors that emerged during the first year of my training as an anesthesia resident at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. I was in my very first week of residency when my chest filled with liters of lymphatic fluid, making it difficult for me to breathe. So I've started actually describing that period as learning to do the work of breathing for others while also learning what it feels like to quite literally lose my own air. That was a very unusual finding for me clinically. So my physicians were appropriately concerned, which prompted a very rapid workup. And because I was fortunate enough to be in a system that knew how to sniff out unusual situations and rare diagnoses, I was actually quite fortunate to be diagnosed with my disease within 36 hours of onset of my symptoms. And so it really was a combination of the liters of lymphatic fluid in my chest with the findings on the CAT scan, which demonstrated innumerable tiny cystic lesions. And taken together, that really was pathognomonic for a very rare lung disease called lymphangioleiomyomatosis, or LAM, L-A-M for short. It's an estrogen-sensitive, progressive lung disease that has a predilection for women of childbearing age. And that really upended the trajectory that I had envisioned for myself as a physician. And I would say that is kind of where my path to where I am today began. Although, it was quite convoluted. I was fortunate enough to be able to return to clinical training after a number of weeks once my acute medical issues were appropriately managed. But certainly, I would say that my experience in training and then as an attending physician has always been shaped by the duality of being simultaneously a clinician while also a patient at the same time. And I have never been one without the other. That confers a very unique lens in which to move through the healthcare system, in which to better understand the clinical encounter. But it is also a challenge and a burden, and it can be quite heavy to carry at times. And so that ultimately led to my interest in exploring conversations and spaces where clinicians are perhaps suffering or have invisible burdens. I would say that's applicable to many of us in medicine. How do we carry that alongside excellent clinical care, while also learning how to be more present and empathetic for the patients that we are tasked to care for?
Is this something you find is not typically taught in medical school?
Well, I went to medical school quite a while ago by now. I think that there is much more of an effort to integrate a more holistic, humanistic approach to clinical care in recent years. And I think certainly the COVID-19 pandemic brought that to top of mind for many training institutions and medical schools. But for me personally, when I went through medical school, and this was again before my rare disease diagnosis, it was not as emphasized as I think it could have been. But as I said, I do think that culture and that expectation is changing. And I think that medical students and trainees are looking for those spaces and those conversations so that they can feel more attuned to what patients are going through and also more connected to one another and to themselves as they go through the rigors of what it means to become a physician and how that becomes a part of your professional identity.
You recently wrote about, and this was for the parent of this podcast is the American Association for Physician Leadership. And you wrote an essay about being in a dual physician couple. So your spouse is a physician. Can you tell me about your spouse?
Happily. My spouse's name is Vincent. We were very kindly invited to co-author an essay, which became a chapter in the AAPL's compendium on dual physician marriage, which is just such a unique and lovely collection of testaments and lived experience on what it means to be truly immersed in medicine, both in your professional as well as in your personal life. I met Vincent at the University of Pennsylvania during the onset of both of our training. He, at the time, was an internal medicine resident and is currently practicing as an interventional cardiologist. He did two fellowships, one in structural and one in interventional. So he's extremely accomplished. He's an extraordinary individual and an even better husband. And his presence and his willingness to stay during those acute moments of my rare disease diagnosis truly shaped, I would say, the trajectory, not just of our relationship and ultimately our marriage, but also my life and the path that I'm on now. So I would say that having a second physician in the relationship is quite convenient when you are yourself dealing with a medical conundrum, a medical oddity, which no one wants to be. And I found myself in the unfortunate position of being in that situation. But it was actually Vincent who, when he was scrolling through the slices of my CT scan, I remember so clearly where we were. That moment is crystallized in my memory, and we reflect on it not infrequently together, in fact, sitting on bar stools at our kitchen counter in our tiny one-bedroom apartment in downtown Philadelphia. And, you know, we did the thing that you're not supposed to do, right, which is opened your own medical record and started scrutinizing it for answers and for clarity. And he actually knew what Lamb was because Penn is just such a broad and well resourced institution that we see, you know, the so-called zebras all the time. And I had not come across it clinically, but he had, and he was the one who looked at me and just said, "This is progressive. There's no cure. It's estrogen sensitive." And then after that, he was just silent. And I knew in that moment that my life, our future together, if we had one, was going to be transformed forever. This was one of those moments where you look back and you think, wow, that was really kind of a threshold that would ultimately change everything. So we detail that moment in the essay, and then I try to really kind of detail out to the reader how Vincent's decisions from that moment on really were the mainstay of everything else that was to come.
Well, not only can you both practice medicine, you can write. It's a beautiful essay. And it opens very interestingly with Rodin's Gates of Hell standing beside you on your wedding day at the Rodin Museum in Philadelphia, which you chose intentionally, not only for the abject beauty, but for what those gates represent, standing at a threshold, acknowledging that suffering's coming, and choosing to walk through it together. Tell us how the essay came together and what you most wanted it to say.
It really began with that image of the gates of hell, as you said, Mike, standing beside us on our wedding day, and the question of what it means to say your vows, to promise to one another that you will build a life next to something ominous like that. Not to conquer it, not to pretend it's not there, but just to stay present beside it. We married in June of 2016 in the courtyard of the Rodin Museum, as you said, such a special and unique cultural institution in Philadelphia. But also the gates of hell, they were right there. And just to describe it a little bit more, they are imposing and just totally awe-inspiring, 6 meters and in totally cast in bronze, and more than, I think, 150 figures suspended in literal agony and suffering. Rodin spent many decades on this piece, and it was initially commissioned to depict Dante's Inferno. But in my experience of just standing in front of it, taking it all in, it almost becomes a tableau or a landscape of the human experience itself, of grief and of ruin and of longing and chaos as well, and uncertainty. It imposed a lot of just overwhelm and so much emotionality. And in many ways, that's what marriage is. And so we thought a lot about that and really centering it in the essay when we were writing it. But also, to your point, we thought it was a really beautiful juxtaposition of what we were promising to one another on our wedding day, what we had already been through, because at that time when I was diagnosed, it was even before we were engaged, Mike. We had only been dating for less than a year. Mm. So we had already been through so much in such a short amount of time. And we decided to get married 3 years after my LAM diagnosis. And so I think the gravity of what we were kind of agreeing to had already sort of been laid out for us, if that makes sense. And so what I most wanted the essay to impart is that tenderness survives. Not easily and not without cost, but if you're willing to be intentional and to keep choosing it, something really beautiful can still emerge from all of that chaos. And that felt very true to what we had been through as a couple, you know, as I said, as crystallized in that moment, you know, at our kitchen counter, staring at that chest CT and realizing the future is not going to look like what we thought it would, together as a couple or really even professionally for both of us.
Well, the Rodin gates are certainly an interesting and thoughtful backdrop for marriage. Although I must say not typical, right? Most people don't look for Dante's Inferno for inspiration pre-matrimony.
Fair
especially
enough.
especially with the opening lines of the Inferno being "Abandon hope, all ye who enter."
We can maybe talk to Vincent and see how he feels about marriage and the gates of hell and those opening lines.
We won't get into any further translation of Nor Dante. But is your life together move forward? There was a time. And this is the essay you share this. I don't want to get too personal, but where you make embryos together. Is that mm-hmm. is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm happy to share that experience. And we were intentional about including that in the essay, Mike, because of how that decision intersects with sort of a systems argument that I think it's important to pay attention to when it comes to rare diseases like Lam and women's reproductive health. But I think it's important to share sort of these stories to illustrate what the opportunities are for improvement, where the gaps are. And again, going back to the reality that Vincent and I were and are both physicians who were moving through these very challenging, difficult decisions and conversations between ourselves and with our healthcare team, it's very easy to imagine that for those who are not as entrenched in the system, that it would be much more challenging. So there was definitely a reason why we wanted to illustrate what that experience looked like for us. And let me also say that what I've come to understand is that when you're handed a very rare condition and a diagnosis, you are largely left to figure out the rest and what that costs in terms of time and in terms of outcomes, and in the very particular kind of exhaustion that comes from carrying all of that uncertainty alone, that has really become a central part of what I'm focusing on now in advocacy and in trying to raise awareness of these issues. So I'll go back to what you asked, though. The decision to pursue IVF and to create embryos together, again, before we were married. That was one of the most vulnerable moments of my life, because what I now realize, I was asking Vincent at the time, or basically saying to him, I may die from this. I know that is a very real possibility. Do you still want to build something with me? And I don't think I spend enough time reflecting on that, but that is such an enormous thing to put on someone, especially mm-hmm. when you're not married or engaged yet. And Vincent, he did not hesitate. He said yes, and we moved forward. And the logistics of IVF are very complex and really quite overwhelming. But the decision for him and his willingness to move forward, it is so momentous. And again, is really why we have the life that we do, because he jumped in with both feet and said, let's do it. Yes, there are so many things to be fearful of. Yes, there is so much uncertainty, but I am ready and willing to plant my flag in this and say, I'm going to stand here with you, and we will try to preserve the possibility of a future together. And for us in that moment, that really meant creating embryos. So we froze embryos, and then we kind of just moved on for a little bit. I think we were eager to know that we did what we could, and then we wanted mm-hmm. to sort of get back to that initial trajectory before Lam and everything that came with it sort of upended everything that we had laid out so carefully. So we put them in the freezer. We returned to our training. We became attendings, and then COVID arrived, and that really changed everything again. So there are these kind of moments, I would say, within the past 10 to 12 years. It seems like every 4 to 5 years, we're sort of met with this crisis on a micro or a macro level where we really have to reevaluate and reprioritize everything very intentionally as a couple.
You briefly touched on this, but I think it's an important point. You and your husband are very well suited to handle certain things, or at least as well as anyone could be. But there are lots of folks out there without any kind of medical education, perhaps in a rural area without access to the tremendous health system that you have. And you're an advocate for these people. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
There was always an awareness of how much infrastructure and the availability of resources that Vincent and I had at our fingertips, that the vast majority of women with rare disease and women with LAM more specifically do not. We both had accessibility to colleagues and to experts that we could reach out to directly. We had the ability to not just read the literature that was available on the questions as it pertains to LAM and reproductive decisions and family planning, but we could also, you know, make some sense of it and use it as data to inform and guide our own decisions. And we also had the confidence to sort of push forward and to ask those difficult questions in the clinical encounter, or to ask for a second or third or fourth opinion as we felt appropriate, which I don't think many would feel confident enough to do so. So I think that was a huge realization for both of us. And I think the more time that goes on and the more I reflect on it, the bigger that gap to me becomes at a systems level. And what really crystallized it for me was actually quite recently, I co-authored a paper with a colleague, and we looked at educational attainment among women with LAM, with my disease, and its relationship to treatment and to various outcomes. And what we found is that women with a graduate degree or higher are actually more than twice as likely to be on the only FDA-approved treatment for LAM, and it's called sirolimus. Most people are familiar with it in the context of immunosuppression for solid organ transplant, but it's a monotherapy for LAM. But if you compare that use of that medication to something like oxygen utilization, which is a little bit more clinically obvious, there is no relationship to educational attainment on the patient's part whatsoever. So why is that? Why is there that discrepancy? Why is there that contrast? Our interpretation is that it illuminates the reality that sirolimus requires navigation. It requires someone who knows how to push for it, the ability to tolerate, I guess, ambiguity, I would say, and also, this isn't talked about a lot in the rare disease space, but the social capital to advocate enough when the system itself is not designed to make these conversations and these topics easy. Oxygen, by contrast, is a little bit more straightforward. As I said, it's more obvious, but a disease-modifying treatment like sirolimus, that is not a straightforward conversation. So the women who have access to it and then decide to go on it with their clinicians, those are usually the women who already have more resources to begin with. And so I think it's not too far of a leap or a stretch to say that the same logic can apply and probably does apply to many of these reproductive decisions that I experience, that other women with LAM and with rare diseases face across life stages and across one's lifetime. And it's not just with regard to IVF, it applies to pregnancy counseling. It applies to, yes, fertility preservation, in addition to planning for a delivery. If you yourself decide to become pregnant or become pregnant, and also hormonal transitions such as entering perimenopause and then menopause itself. Currently, there is no formal pathway or playbook to guide any of these decisions, as we experienced firsthand, again, two physicians deeply in the system. And what became clear to me by participating in this work that I just described, and also through my lived experience, is what fills those gaps at a systems level is largely luck. It's geography. So to your point about proximity and potentially being located in a rural area, that plays a big role. So do personal and professional networks. So does persistence and privilege. And I benefited from it in all the right ways, but that's not necessarily right. And it's also not the best way to build a system for those who largely live on the periphery already. So I think what I'm trying to do through this essay, and also through opportunities and conversations like this one, is to use the personal as a data point and as a story to highlight that this is actually a structural issue.
You've founded the LAM Foundation's Clinical Advisory Board. Can you tell me about the advisory board?
The advisory board is a phenomenal resource, not only for LAM patients and their families, but also for other clinicians who work in pulmonology and treat women with LAM and other interstitial lung diseases. We are fortunate to have the breadth and depth of expertise and experience across institutions with an international footprint that really taps into a core of knowledge, which is just extraordinary for such a rare disease. It's currently being led by three outstanding physicians who have various degrees of seniority and academic appointments, but together have really led this group of physicians into, I think, an extremely cohesive, well-integrated unit that provides a lot of care and support for women who are grappling with what it means to navigate the initial moments of diagnosis, as well as continue to serve as a resource and a source of support as we go through our journeys with this disease, because it is progressive. Even with an FDA-approved treatment, that does not necessarily mean it is effective for everybody. And so really being able to pool all of that knowledge and all of that expertise into an accessible network is so critical, as I said, not just for patients and families and loved ones, but also for the clinicians to be able to learn from one another. So I helped to organize, but I am certainly not a clinician who treats LAM. I rather just saw the opportunity to bring some of these experts who are volunteers, by the way. This is out of generosity of spirit and deep and thoughtful care for LAM patients, that they really donate their time and are willing to participate in this way.
It occurs to me that you may be using rare disease in as a term of art. I don't know. Is there a specific definition for rare disease for you, or using it in the more general term that it's just wildly uncommon?
Well, technically speaking, a rare disease is generally defined as a condition affecting fewer than 200,000 individuals. So there is sort of a metrics-based threshold that determines whether something is a rare disease or not. For LAM in particular, it was once thought that it affected maybe 7 to 8 women per 1 million women. But we now know that it's actually much closer to, I think, 20 to 24 per 1 million women. And so the interesting reality about what we call a rare disease is that it may actually be rare simply by virtue of the fact that it is vastly underdiagnosed. And that speaks to the very urgent and critical need for awareness and visibility of conditions like LAM, so that if a woman presents in a variety of clinical settings, whether it's at her OB-GYN with difficulty breathing and shortness of breath and potentially collapsed lung, or whether they go into the emergency room with severe abdominal pain and a growth found on their kidney, which is another finding of lymphangeal leiomyomatosis, that physicians are able to include LAM as part of their differential diagnosis, particularly if the woman is of childbearing age. And so that has really become a critical core of the work that we are doing at the LAM Foundation, which is the premier patient advocacy and research organization for LAM globally, and something that has become very important to me as a personal and professional mission, is to really ensure that as many clinicians who are out there practicing, and certainly those that interface specifically with women of this demographic, are aware that this disease exists, and to know what some of the more common presentations and symptomatology may be.
Do you ever feel that your advocacy and focus upon LAM, a condition that you have, takes an emotional toll on you?
It's an interesting question. I think that as physicians, we are trained in a way, whether implicitly or otherwise, to be expert compartmentalizers. It helps in a way to maintain some emotional distance from the acuity of what may be unfolding in front of you in the operating room, in the intensive care unit, or in the office. But at the same time, I think that living with LAM, living with this rare disease, has made me a more honest physician. And I should just say, for full transparency, I am currently not actively treating patients. But certainly when I was patient facing and when I was clinically active, I think I had more patience for sitting in that uncertainty with the people that I was tasked to care for, that I recognized the singular importance in a way of accompanying someone with presence when they are extremely vulnerable. And as an anesthesiologist, we find ourselves in those moments all the time, typically right before a patient falls asleep before a surgery is when they are most vulnerable, when they are most afraid. And I found that regardless of age or if it's a man or a woman or a child, what they most want in that moment is to know that they're not alone and to have someone hold their hand. So I think that what I tried to do as a practicing clinician, and what I try to do now in my work for visibility and advocacy for LAM and rare diseases that affect women, is to really be present and to channel any of that grief and suffering that I personally experienced and continue to carry with me into something that can be productive and also make a difference for others.
It strikes me that medicine is both an art and a science, and your answer clearly demonstrates the beauty of the art of medicine. Great, great, great answer, doctor. I want to end our time together where your essay ends, not with a systems view, but with the person inside it. You write that Rodin eventually removed the kiss from the gates of hell because it was thought to be too tender, too alive. It disrupted the landscape of suffering around it, at least in Rodin's opinion. And you ask, what are we allowed to hold on to in the midst of pain? What tenderness survives? Can you elaborate a little on that?
I feel like goes back to something I said earlier in our conversation, Mike, which is that tenderness survives when it's chosen with intention and repeatedly, even when it feels contradictory to what's happening in the moment or when it feels out of place. Maybe especially when it feels out of place is when we should reach for it and when we should choose it. And I think the decision to remove the kiss from the gates of hell, you know, at least at first blush makes a lot of sense. If you've seen the kiss, it's just so beautiful. It's luminous even. And it doesn't really seem to fit in that landscape of suffering that I described at the onset of our conversation. But I think that maybe if we apply a similar lens to medicine, that if we remove tenderness because it feels disruptive or it takes too much time or it feels out of place, that may cost something profound either in that moment or further down the line, both as physicians and as human beings. So I think it's really just about understanding on a deeper level that as a patient or as a clinician, sometimes as both, as a partner of someone who's going through illness, whether it's acute or chronic, whether it's treatable or life-limiting, you don't have to remove the tenderness, and you also don't have to feel like you're going to conquer the pain and the suffering in order to survive it. It almost goes back to the idea of what the gates of hell represented for us on our wedding day. It's the reality that you can still choose to build a life beside all of that. And I'll just take it back to Vincent again. You know, he chose to do that with me. He stayed, and he stayed with intention and with a very real awareness of what was unfolding for us in that moment and what could happen in the future. It's a choice to stay present, even if it's hard, even if you know it could bring more suffering to you, to us. But to keep reaching for tenderness anyway, even when logic or whatever is happening around you would argue against it. And I think that's really very difficult. It's deliberate, but it's also extremely beautiful and very important.
Dr. Hoy, this has been a great interview for me. Very thoughtful answers, and I hope that you and your husband write more essays together. You have a real gift. Anything that our audience should know is coming, as far as writings from you or your husband.
Well, thank you very much for those kind words, Mike. I deeply appreciate it. And nothing yet, but we'll be sure to keep AAPL posted.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for your time. My guest has been Lindsay Hoy. Thank you, Dr. Hoy.
Thank you.
My thanks to Lindsay Hoy. Dr. Hoy reminds us that tenderness in medicine is not a disruption. It is, in fact, the point. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. That is holy cow, Batman and Robin. Ritual Kapow.